For those of you who are still eating, you may want to hasten the pace because you may soon find that you have no appetite to continue eating. And so I will introduce Debbie in a little bit. I'll explain kind of how I got to know her and kind of my story into how I got so engaged into this whole topic and reality of human trafficking. And a little bit about myself first, though. I have... I'm married to Ginger. She's my wife, and we've been married for 7 years. We have three children, Chloe, Logan, and Paige, and one on the way. And as Gay said, a pastor at Finland Mennonite, have been in that capacity going into my third year, and it's been a real joy to see how the Lord can lead in many surprising ways. But I was having a conversation the other day with my son, and we have chickens, and we were looking at getting chickens. We have them now, but him and Logan, what kind of chickens do you want? Well, how about a boy chicken? And hey, we can probably do that. We can get a couple roosters, and so we got some roosters, and he was happy. And you know, the interesting thing about what we say and even how we say it is oftentimes the context in which we say it. And so my son asked. He said, "How about a boy?" And you know, we all chuckled, and so here's another story, and you might not chuckle at this one. We were in Chau Dac, which is a city in Vietnam. I was there with Steve Chris when my biblical classmates for our IME trip. It's an experience to get you into another culture, and we were headed to a hotel, and every time you walk out of a hotel in Vietnam, there's always people waiting for you. They're usually on a, I don't know the technical term, probably someone in the audience does. It's a bike with like a basket behind it, and they say, "Hey, can I give you a ride?" It's kind of their form of taxis, and they're everywhere, and they usually follow you for a little bit. If you say no the first time, they'll kind of ride beside you and behind you, and they'll keep asking. And so we had this experience where two of our guys came walking out, and "Hey, would you like a ride?" "No thanks, we're gonna walk." And so this guy proceeded to follow them and kept asking them more and more questions, and they're like, "No, we like walking." And so then he changed his strategy, and he said, "Well, what about a woman? I can get you a woman." And they were like, no, really, no, absolutely. We don't want that. We don't need that. We're just going for a walk." And so he wasn't giving up, and he said, "Well, I can get a younger woman for you." And they're like, "No, sir, we don't want it." And then the question that has haunted many of us probably since that night was, "Well, how about a boy?" I can imagine walking in Vietnam, trying to go to a hotel room, and being off. And so that started my journey into human trafficking. Met with IJM, International Justice Mission, in Cambodia, and learned what they were doing. And they're an awesome organization doing some really awesome work. And all Christ-based, which is phenomenal. And so I came back home, kind of still haunted by this, but incredibly encouraged by the work of IJM. And one of our young adults happened to go to a Passion Conference that year, which is down in Georgia, put on by a guy by Louis Giglio and his crew. If you've never heard of Passion Fest, I encourage you to look into it and encourage your young adults to attend. So he went down to that, and he came back, and one of the things that they focus on is human trafficking and really bringing it to the fore of these young adults' minds. And so he came back all fired up. He's like, "We got to do something. We got to get the awareness." And I'm like, "Yeah, absolutely. Why don't we contact IJM and we'll put a night together?" And so we did. And IJM have liaisons all throughout. And one of their liaisons, I don't know if that's a technical term, you can give them the real term then, was Debbie. And so on a night at Finland, we got introduced to the horrors and the realities of trafficking, not just in Cambodia, not just around the world, but in Pennsylvania, in Montgomery County, in our own backyards. And so that created this relationship. Debbie is now undertaking the amazing task of putting together a documentary and really blowing open the realities of trafficking in Pennsylvania specifically. And so The church at Finland has decided we're going to support her in that, and we've been walking along with her through that for over a year now, I believe. Was recently at an event at The Well, which is a refuge place for women and others who are rescued from trafficking. And this is right in Souderton. I can't tell you more than that, but that's where it is. But just the fact that we have a refuge house in Souderton should open our eyes to the realities of what's going on. And so that's kind of been our journey. It's been our walk, and we're interested and always in touch with Debbie to say, what can we do more? How can we get more involved? What are other things we can be doing? And so the conversation has begun to spread. And so as part of that, we as a conference wanted to bring together everybody. How can we mobilize together and fight this thing together, not just be doing our own things in our own ways, but really make a joint effort in it and see what kind of light we can shed into the darkness when we come together in the name of Jesus. And so with that, I'll call up Miss Debbie Wright and allow her to correct any of my mistakes that I may have said and shed even more light and information on what we can do. Thank you, Debbie.
Thank you. Let me just move this over here. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking time out to, as Chris said, learn about something that's really not very appetizing. But I will tell you, let's put this down. Sorry about that. I will tell you that this is very special to me because, as Chris mentioned, over a year ago when I went and spoke at Finland, I was actually in the process of deciding whether or not to quit my job and to work on the film. And Dan Emmer from The Well was there and talked to me about his journey. And then Finland has been praying for me, prayed me through that decision, and has really supported me. So there's a very special place in my heart. So it's nice that it kind of came full circle. A year after this, we started filming in April, and here I am with all of you. And the Mennonite group has a very special heart in general, so but Finland in particular. So it's really a pleasure to be here today. And you know, in talking to Sandy and hearing her say, I really feel like I'm at the ground level of understanding this issue, and that's why I'm here today. I would imagine that each one of you has a very unique journey in terms of how you got here, why you're here, and maybe what you know or what you don't know about human trafficking. And, you know, I'm really pleased to hear that what will come out of this are some action steps. I hope together as a group that you will, you know, go out and pray, as will be talked about later, over some areas where they really need prayer and where we need to take back the land, so to speak. But also in your individual churches, the influence and the power that you have that God has entrusted you with is, you know, is something that can touch countless lives for generations to come in regards to this issue. And so for me, it's a real honor to be able to speak to you, because I just know that coming out of this, there's going to be a span of people in your communities and even further and for generations to come who will be impacted by this. So I'm just thrilled to be here today. And you know, for me, I think about what brings us together, and I think there's probably four reasons why I would say that we've all come together this morning. And one is that, you know, human trafficking, we may not know a lot about it, but we know there's a level of violence and oppression and darkness. And so I would say thank you for choosing to relate to and to step into darkness and pain and suffering. And my guess is that each one of you has a story of either their own lives or someone in your community or someone in your family where you have seen a tremendous amount of pain in their lives and you've chosen to sort of relate to that suffering. And so because of that humanity in us and the Christ in us, we choose to do that. And it is a choice because we can turn away from it. So I thank you for your courage and your choice today. And I would say, but even with that choice to decide that you want to relate to it, but then to take it even further and to want to learn more about it, and to maybe think about what to do, I would say that that reflects truly the joy of Christ and the great love. Because this issue, interestingly enough, I was watching something on Breast Cancer Awareness Month is in October, right? And there are so many stories of courageous people who have fought the fight of cancer. We've all been touched by that. So having walked in cancer walks and done an MS ride and whatnot because of people that have been in my life, you know, it's It's a little easier when it's either been in your own life or someone that you care about to care about an issue. But interestingly enough, very few of us have actually had someone in our family or someone in our community that we know and we're close to who's been trafficked. And so for people to step out for an issue that personally doesn't involve them, that really doesn't, you know, doesn't impact their lives, so to speak, it really is a reflection of Christ's love. Because it really is, in a sense, taking care of the widows and the orphans. And why the widows and the orphans? Because there's such a disconnect between them. They're the abandoned people. And so the trafficking people in many ways have been abandoned in many situations. So your choice to relate to this issue for people that you would have very little, you know, reason to be in contact with other than showing the love and the joy of Christ is really, I applaud that as well. And I know that's not why you're here, but that is exactly what Christ wants us to do. And the other thing that I would say is I hope a reason why you're here is because you're waiting in expectation. Because the truth of the matter is, when I start to tell you all about this, and when you start to feel that pit in your stomach, and when you start to feel that pull of discouragement and despair and being overwhelmed, if there wasn't any hope, there would be no point. If there wasn't a way that we could eradicate this, if there wasn't a way that we could rescue people, there wasn't a way that we could stop it and prevent it from happening, then there would be no reason for us to all come together. But we know that with Christ, all things are possible, and we know the hope that lies therein. And I think about, no matter how old that we get, that we all love stories of rescue. The Bible is full of them. But you think about your own kids, or even when you were young, and how exciting was to read a fairy tale where you had sort of the against all odds situation, and, you know, and it seemed very evil and dark and hopeless. And then, yet, here comes a great warrior. Here comes somebody to save the day. And we all, there's a part of us, I believe, that God created that we long to see that. We long for that action in our lives. We long to see God move in a way of the stories of the Old Testament in particular, where the sea is parted and all of that. Those are all true. So we long to see that. So this is an amazing issue in the horrors of it, but also the incredible hope and the miracles that we see happen on every day. So I would say that that's another reason why maybe everybody's come together, and certainly our own salvation is a great story of rescue, isn't it? And so really the rescue of people out of this is such a great way of sort of living that out. But in particular, I want to say for the Mennonite body of believers that you have an amazing history and legacy of fighting against slavery. And it's one of the things that in the film we're actually going to take a look at is in Pennsylvania in particular, because Pennsylvania really has deep roots in fighting for freedom from the foundation of America through different times in our history. But, you know, as you know, and I'm sure I'm telling you things that you already know, but the Mennonites suffered around the world persecution heavily, came to America as part of William Penn coming here, actually, the first settlers. Some of them were Mennonites. And the Mennonites over time have been known for their opposition to slavery. In fact, in 1688, there was the first meeting and the first sort of published thing around slavery. And I wanted to read that to you. It's very short. It was called The Minute. And I wanted you to read what they wrote, what was discussed there. It was called The First Protest Against Slavery. These are the reasons why we are against the traffic. And what's interesting is that I didn't even know it was called trafficking back then. Why we are against the traffic of men body as followeth. Is there anyone that would be done or handled in this manner, vis-a-vis to be sold or made a slave for all the time of his life? How fearful and faint-hearted are many on sea when they see a strange vessel, being afraid it should be a Turk, and they should be taken and sold for slaves in Turkey. Now what is this better done, as Turks do? Yea, rather it is worse for them which say they are Christians. For we hear that most part of such niggers are brought hither against their will and consent, and that many of them are stolen. Now they are black. We cannot conceive there is more liberty to have them as slaves as it is to have other white ones. There is a saying that we shall do to all men like we would be done to ourselves, making no difference of what generation, descent, or color they are. And those who steal or rob men, and those who buy or purchase them, are they not all alike? Here is the liberty of conscience, which is right and reasonable. Here ought to be liberty of body, except of evildoers, is another case. But to bring men hither, or to rob and sell them against their will, we stand against. In Europe, there are many oppressed for conscience' sake, and here there are those who are oppressed are of black color. And we know that men must not commit adultery. Some do commit adultery in separating wives from their husbands and giving them to others, and some sell the children of these poor creatures to other men. Ah, do consider, will this thing, you who do it, if you would be done at this manner. And if it is done accordingly to Christianity, you surpass Holland and Germany in this thing. This makes an ill report in all of these countries of Europe where they hear of that ye Quakers do here handle men as they handle their cattle. And for that reason, some have no mind or inclination to come hither. And who shall maintain this your cause or plead for it? Truly we cannot do so except that you shall inform us better hereof, vis-a-vis that Christians have liberty to practice these things. Pray what thing in the world can be done worse towards us that if men weigh and sell us for slaves to strange countries, separating husbands from their wives and children, being now that this is not done in the manner which we would be done, and therefore we contradict and are against the traffic of purchasing such things as are stolen, but rather to help this robbing and stealing if possible. And such men ought to be delivered out of the hands of robbers and set free, as well as in Europe. This, then, is Pennsylvania to have a good report. Instead, it hath now a bad one for this sake in other countries, especially whereas Europeans are desirous to know in what manner Quakers do rule in their province, and most of them do look upon us with an envious eye. But if this is done well, what shall we say is done evil? Now consider, will this thing, if it is good or bad, and in case you find it to be good to handle these blacks in that matter, we desire and require that you hereby lovingly, that you may inform us herein, which at this time has never been done, vis-a-vis that Christians have such liberty to do so. To that end, we shall be satisfied in this point, and satisfy likewise our good friends and acquaintances and our native country, to who it is a terror or a fearful thing that men should be handled so in Pennsylvania. So this was the first open decree against slavery, which was done by the Mennonites, and in the state of Pennsylvania, which has this tremendous history and richness, and I think God had a very specific plan for Pennsylvania. In fact, they haven't been able to find in records in Pennsylvania, Maryland, or Virginia of any Mennonite who actually owned a slave. Doesn't mean it didn't happen, but there's been no records anywhere in those states. And one quote that I love by a Mennonite named Mary Brenneman was, "There will be no slavery in heaven and ought not to be none here." The Underground Railroad, which you're all familiar with, there were many Mennonites who were involved in that. And in fact, Mennonites used their power of voting to try to put people in office who basically were against slavery, and so basically opposed anyone who was for slavery. They also in the South opposed secession. And so I just wanted to share this with you. And there was an abolitionist group that came together in 1775, and they had sort of three goals. And it's ironic to me how those three things are the things that changed the course of history and basically stopped slavery in the state of Pennsylvania and actually throughout the United States. One was awareness, so kudos to you for being here today. Two was to change laws, which I'm going to talk about later. And then the other was to help people who had been victimized. And so look at the difference that they made. And so here you are today. So you are in a very unique position with a tremendous legacy of people who have gone before you. I think the Mennonites, something God put something in your hearts as a group of believers to fight against slavery and to stand in the face of this. And I just want to share this with you, which I really haven't shared anywhere else that I've spoken at. But I want to share with you what my legacy is. And this is my legacy. This is a picture of, you know who this is, General Lee, and this is someone in my family who grew up in the South. My family's from Alabama. We were cotton farmers, and we owned slaves. And this is where I came from. This is the legacy that I had. So when I grew up, there was obviously never any discussion of slaves. And very recently, some of my family was up visiting. And I said, isn't it ironic that when I read through the genealogy of our family initially and read through slaves, it didn't even register with me? And recently I went back and I reread that, and I was horrified to find out that my family owned slaves. We perpetrated oppression and violence against people in the South. And my family was proud. I have cotton from one of the farms that we had, and I have a quilt that was made from it. And my aunt, who is, I think, misinformed about this, said, but they didn't beat the slaves. They were humane, but they were still owned by my family. So this is the legacy that I have. So I just want to thank you for, you know, the legacy that you bring, because you changed the course of history in the United States. I believe you will continue to do that. And for people like me who grew up with a different kind of legacy, and I don't look like I'm from the South, I don't have a Southern accent, but I have very deep roots, and quite frankly, I come from a place of slavery and of oppression. And so I just want you to understand how important it is that you continue on this legacy. So with that, I just want to pray before we really get started into talking about modern day slavery. Heavenly Father, I just thank you so much for every single person that is here today, Lord, for their hearts for this issue, Lord, and quite frankly, for the heart of the Mennonite body of believers over the years who not only suffered persecution, but then came here and really fought against slavery. And I just ask, Lord, that you would speak to each person who's here, that you would put upon their hearts what it is that you want them to do with this information, Lord, at their churches and as a community of leaders, Lord. Lord, that you would give me the words that you would have me say in spite of the notes that are here today, Lord. And Lord, that today the world would be changed, certainly in America, especially in Pennsylvania, as a result of everybody coming together. And I thank you for this precious time of everybody coming together. And I just ask that you would, your presence would be so strong here today. And I ask all this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, so I'm going to go over the basics of trafficking and tell you a lot about human trafficking. I'm not sure exactly what you know, but I have to set the context for why this is so important that that we get involved. The Trafficking of Victims Protection Reauthorization Act of 2008 defines severe forms of human trafficking, and I'm going to talk specifically a little bit more about sex trafficking, less about labor trafficking, as the recruitment, transportation, harboring, provision, or obtaining of persons for sex trafficking in which commercial sex act is induced by force, fraud, or coercion, or in which the person induced to perform such an act has not attained 18 years of age. So it doesn't matter if you're under the age of 18. If you're being sold for sex, then you are considered a victim, and thank God for that. But what I like about this definition is the idea of coercion, okay, or tricking someone. Because the truth of the matter is, a misconception is that people are, you know, dragged across international lines, and it does happen, or they're kidnapped, and it is by physical force that they are caught up into trafficking and being sold as victims. But the truth of the matter is that the traffickers nowadays are a lot more sophisticated than that, and they don't necessarily need to do that, and I'll talk a little bit about that later. So there are ways that they trick people into it, use against people, used powers of psychological manipulation and control, and that's how, honestly, some people get pushed into human trafficking. So without these definitions being in place for human trafficking, the truth of the matter is there would be a lot of cases that couldn't be prosecuted. And thank God that now the laws were changed on a federal level, and praise the Lord that in Pennsylvania we recently passed some laws that will help us effectively prosecute them. The statistics are shocking, and they're gut-wrenching. And I'm going to tell you now that your instinct, as mine was, is to want to shut it down and feel overwhelmed. And I just want to share with you that there's hope, there's hope, there's hope. I don't want you to forget that. So I'm going to challenge you today to step into the discomfort, because God calls us, and if you really read the Bible and go through the Bible, God never allows people to stay in their comfort zone. Every single time, every story that we're told is of people stepping out in faith and stepping into areas where they have great discomfort or where they're fearful. And so I'm going to ask you to take that journey with me today, and I think you'll be glad that you did. The reality is that they're estimating that there's around 27 million slaves around the world, and actually statistics are saying more like 30 million slaves. This is an older number. And it is the, in this time in history, there are the most slaves that we've ever seen in the history of the world. So while we in the United States feel that slavery kind of stopped 150 years ago, the truth of the matter is it's been quietly in our eyes, not necessarily in the places where this is happening, and it's very, you know, and certainly not to the victim survivors, but it has grown rapidly in these last, throughout these centuries. It is the fastest growing crime on the planet, and it is the second largest criminal enterprise after drugs and weapons. And the truth of the matter is, what's happening is because of laws around drugs, and quite frankly, how profitable human trafficking is, you see that people are switching businesses because from an economic perspective, and quite frankly, from an environment that is ripe for that type of business, which we are in the United States and all around the world, it is a good business to be in at this point, and that's why it's growing so rapidly. Destination countries for people who are being trafficked are Belgium, Germany, Greece, Israel, Italy, Japan, Netherlands, Thailand, and Turkey, and of course, the U.S. And they will go to great lengths to obtain victims. I mean, this is a money, this is so profitable. This is, you know, something that's going to make you very wealthy very quickly. And so if you have a victim and you can sell them over and over and over again for several years, if it takes you a few months and if it takes you to set up a shop and pretend like you have, you know, job opportunities somewhere and throw some posters up and do some interviews, you know, and pretend like you're going to be shipping them over to a country and that they'll have opportunities, of course you're going to do that because there's so much money to be made. I mean, it's your initial investment in what will be a very profitable enterprise. And, you know, traffickers will sometimes give job training. We even see it in the United States where, you know, you've heard about this before, where model agencies, you know, I have a model agency, why don't you come out to Las Vegas? And the next thing you know, one of the victims that I'm aware of, you know, was stripping in a bar and had to run for her life ultimately. So it is the perfect crime with great rewards. And I just want to share some things with you around the world, and then I want to come back to the United States. In Eastern Europe, one person who sells a woman potentially can get $2,000 a week for each girl, or just $24,000 a year just to supply a girl. I'm not talking about that you're involved once the girl's been handed over. You're just an intermediary person who is facilitating the relationship between this person and then them being moved into trafficking, $24,000 a year for one person, all right? Up to 70,000 North Korean women have been trafficked into China for forced marriage and sexual slavery. In the Netherlands, it's a billion-dollar a year industry. There's about 2,000 brothels, and 68 to 80% of women come from other countries. So in places where it is legal, an argument has often been made that that reduces human trafficking, but where there is demand, there will be supply, and the supply will get there in whatever means is necessary, and so they are finding in Amsterdam that of course people have been trafficked, of course people are underage that are there, that are being trafficked. In Mombasa, Kenya, it's estimated 30,000 girls between the ages of 12 and 14 are lured into hotels and private villas along the coast with promises of riches and trips abroad. And you can see where the Europeans come in on the sides of the roads and where the boys are kind of lined up as they're heading to the beach, and it's part of all the tourism package there, if you will. In the Philippines, prostitution is the fourth largest source of GNP. They estimate that about 300,000 Japanese tourists come through a year just for sex tourism. The average income in Cambodia is around $300 a year. So the cost for a girl, a six-year-old girl for 1 week, and if the younger they are and if they're virgins, they are in high demand, is $500. So just think about the economic profile of this. Approximately 80% of human trafficking victims are women and girls. 50% are minors. And people are saying that the shift is going more towards children, they're easier to manipulate, and the truth of the matter is the demand is growing for them. UNICEF estimates that 1.2 million children are trafficked into prostitution each year around the world. So that means every day, almost 3,300 children will be sold into sex slavery. And in this hour that we're gonna be together, 137 kids will be sold into sex slavery. And if you think about what is the cost of obtaining someone as a victim. If you think about back to the African slavery days, the average cost in today's terms would be about $40,000. And I don't know how many of you are sports fans, but World Series tickets can go anywhere from $1,300 to $1,600. But you can purchase a child who then you traffic for about $300. That is the value that we have placed on life around the world and the United States. And so right now is a great time to be in the slavery business. And so let's talk about what's happening in the U.S. It's estimated that between 15,000 and 18,000 people are trafficked into the United States across international borders. So there is an element of that people may have heard about that. And here's a quote from the author of Somebody's Daughter. "The United States seems unwilling to recognize that the vast majority of victims of sex trafficking are not foreigners, but the girls next door. The University of Pennsylvania conducted a study in 2001 which showed that between 244,000 and 325,000 American children are at risk of sexual exploitation, including child pornography, juvenile prostitution, and trafficking of children for sexual purposes." And, you know, one of the groups that we know are most at risk of this are obviously runaways and, you know, and kids in foster homes or group homes or whatever, because they have some very basic needs: food, shelter, love, any sort of attention, support, and they are easy picking for these traffickers. And so the traffickers go after these children. And some experts have been saying that within 48 hours of running away, a child who's run away is likely to be approached to participate in prostitution or another form of commercial sexual exploitation. So by the time that you can actually report someone missing, by the way, a trafficker has most likely already approached that particular child who has run away. And one out of every seven endangered runaways reported in 2013 was likely a child, a sex trafficking victim. These victims often end up traveling, being victimized along the highways of America. Route 80, which, you know, connects Pennsylvania to Ohio and to other states heading out west, is a hotbed of human trafficking because you have to move. You have to move the victims all the time, and there's a big demand at truck stops and along the way where people are traveling. And the one thing that I want to sort of, and I'm going to talk about different myths today, one of the things that I want to share with you is that one of the myths is that even kids in the United States are most likely kidnapped by a stranger, and that's how they end up being trafficked. And the truth of the matter is, and this is from the Polly Class Foundation, you know, that what happened to their child. It's important, or to Polly, it's important to know that less than 1% of all missing children have been abducted by strangers. By far the most prevalent type of reported missing children in the United States are runaway, throwaway children. According to the National Runaway Safe Line, between, you know, 2 and 3 million youth run away each year in the United States. And they could be running as young as 10 to 14, and they are most at risk for dangers of street life. So we have a generation of throwaway kids in the United States that are vulnerable to this, but make no mistake about it, these are not the only kids that are being exploited by these traffickers. There is the girl next door, so to speak, or the boy next door, who is absolutely being trafficked by predators in the United States. And I'm going to talk about how that's happening. But I want to sort of talk about how profitable this is in the United States in particular. And let's take an example from, let's say, in Chicago, where you have a trafficker in Chicago who buys three girls for $1,000. And let's say that they make $220 a day or $660 a day altogether, which is about $4,600 a week. And that ends up being about $240,000 a year or $720,000 over, let's say, a three-year period. And so what was your initial investment? Your initial investment was, you know, $1,000, $1,500 in clothes, $4,000 in drugs, because if you give them drugs, they're a little bit easier to manage, and they won't eat as much, quite frankly. And if they do end up getting arrested or they end up in some sort of rescue operation, they're going to start jonesing for those drugs. And, you know, unless there's immediate care for them, which a lot of facilities don't have the ability to help people who are on drugs who have been in a trafficking situation, they need to get those drugs. So they're going to come right back to you. And $5,000, let's say, for food, you have a $709,000 profit. So who's not going to get in that business, right? very profitable in the United States. And if they have AIDS or if they look spent or whatever's going on with them after 3 years, you just throw them away. So this is the landscape in Pennsylvania. In the world, they've estimated that this business is about a $32 billion business. In the United States, estimates are as high as $9 billion. So we're about a third, we are feeding about a third of the worldwide economy for this. And here's something that's really shocking to me personally. If you look at the organizations that are dedicated or have some main purpose in fighting against human trafficking on a worldwide basis, not just in the United States, but on a worldwide basis, and there's some that obviously we wouldn't be able to find because they're small little places and little towns or whatever, but there's probably less than 200 of them worldwide to fight against a $32 billion business, okay? Versus in the United States, we have 3,500 animal shelters that deal with 6 to 8 million cats and dogs. Now, what does that tell you? Now, I love animals. I have a dog. But what does that tell you about the value that we place and how much need there is for people to get involved and for people to support the organizations that are there? If you look at the number of beds in the United States for human trafficking survivors, there's about 1,644, and that's it. And not even facilities that are fully dedicated to human trafficking survivors. Some of those, a good percentage of those, are actually at shelters for other reasons and will take in human trafficking survivors and may not even have the training to deal with a specific trauma and, quite frankly, the safety issues around this. So what does that tell you about where we're at and the urgent need to do something about this? And let's talk about some examples of what's been happening. I don't know if you heard about Operation Cross Country, 350 customers, pimps, children in 16 cities that were arrested. In 2007, 400 children were exploited as child prostitutes in Las Vegas in 1 month. In LA, 17 people arrested in an internet child porn sting, children as young as 3. And let's talk about New Jersey and Pennsylvania, because I can see New Jersey from where I live. I'm on the Delaware River. In Reading, which is not too far away from here, we had a guy who was 46 years old who was trafficking girls ages 14 to 17. He used to call himself God. He wanted everybody to refer to him as God. He was also known to possess child pornography. And by the way, the link between pornography and prostitution, and I will say, and hence human trafficking, is the research is showing the strength of that link because it helps to fuel demand. And if you look at the increase in the availability of child pornography, you can see where then the demand for children, for people to act things that they're seeing in pornography is going up. And if you interview, if you see any research where they've interviewed prostitutes or people who've been trafficked, then you will also see that a lot of times they'll say that Johns wanted them to act out what they were seeing in pornography. So as long as we as a society say that pornography is acceptable, it's healthy in relationships, it's victimless in a sense, we are continuing to help fuel the demand and the sourcing of victims for human trafficking. In Allentown, there was a father and son, family business, who were arrested for sex trafficking, and there was a ring that was involving New York State, and it's not uncommon for New York, New Jersey. In fact, one of the reasons why Pennsylvania is such a great state for human trafficking is because of our geographic location. We're on the 95 corridor, so there's a lot of movement of human trafficking victims all along the East Coast. We've got interstate highways and countries that go or highways that go across the different states, like I mentioned with I-80. We have ports, we have an international airport, and up until recently we had laws that really weren't dealing effectively with this issue. So we are the perfect place for human trafficking to occur, and it is very profitable here. So these girls that were trafficked by this father and son pair in Allentown, the police kept seeing that they were arresting these girls and that they had, you know, certain things in common. They had similar business cards. They had matching tattoos. And tattoos are sometimes an indication. They'll put a barcode or some sort of sign of ownership in a way where another pimp trafficker can look and see that that's someone else's property. So don't mess with my people. But also certainly a message to the person who is being victimized that you are my property and I own you. So tattoos are one of the giveaways. One of them had a barcode above her neck, and another one had a dollar sign on her pelvis. And so finally they were able to rest when they saw that there was just things that were seemed to be in common and break up this ring. In Lancaster, it's pretty epidemic in Lancaster. We're hoping that there'll be an aftercare home that will be open soon here. But there was a girl who confided to her new online friend. One of the ways that traffickers develop relationships is through the internet. And then so she was having a hard time at home. She ended up confiding in her friend. Her friend said, you know, I'll give you a place to stay and I'll take you in. And then that girl ended up being trafficked in Kensington Avenue. And if she refused, she was beaten and raped, which is, you know, which is often what happens to them. In 2005, Operation Precious Cargo was an investigation that targeted sex trafficking at Harrisburg truck stops. More than 150 victims included 45 children as young as 12, and many of the 18 traffickers received long prison sentences. Harrisburg is another area where there's a lot of trafficking that's going on. In Perkiomen Township, there was a 45-year-old man who faced more than 100 felony and misdemeanor prostitution charges. He would pick up each girl a week at a bus station, either in Norristown or Philadelphia, would house her for a week, drive her around to customers, collect the money from her, and then take her back to the bus station and pick up a new girl, you know? Because you don't want to keep them, in some cases, you got to move them a lot, and maybe you don't want to keep them around that long, so there's a lot of movement, which makes it very difficult to investigate and to prosecute. They're very, very sophisticated. And he was supplying these victims to customers in Montgomery, Bucks, Philadelphia, Chester, and Delaware County. So if you think to yourself it is not happening outside of Philadelphia, make no mistake about it, it is happening in every single county in Pennsylvania. And there is a great need for us to do something about it. So I just want to very quickly say that there's a few misconceptions that we need to realize are not true. One is that it is only in Philadelphia, as I mentioned, it is not. It is in every county in Pennsylvania. There's an aftercare home in Philadelphia, one in Philadelphia for all the trafficking that goes on there. Actually another one that's going to be opened up soon, hopefully, and there may be another one that I heard about. There's one in Lancaster that's soon to open. Pastor Chris had mentioned the Well in Bucks County, and hopefully, and another one just opened up in the Lehigh Valley, but they're very limited, and most of them don't take those that are under the age of 18 because it's so difficult from an insurance and all the legal issues that you can run into with minors. So it's so difficult to find somewhere for a minor to go. The other thing is that a misconception is that they're only sort of kids that are runaways or drug addicts, and that is not true. One of the one of the worst places of hunting grounds for traffickers is the mall, King of Prussia Mall. There was a big ring around that. And that's because these traffickers can go in and they can be sort of anonymous. Nobody's really paying attention. Everybody's shopping and doing whatever they're doing. And they can observe groups of children who are there unattended by their parents oftentimes. And they will look at the body language. And so you have maybe a guy who's given a certain amount of money who will go in and he'll charm and get to know someone, and he's just sort of the front guy for it to ultimately then traffic someone. And he'll express interest in, let's say, a young girl in particular, and will end up being her boyfriend. And through that relationship then, will use that relationship and her love for him against him, or against her, to actually then end up trafficking her. So traffickers will go and get the victims wherever they are. They will send people to parties, on the cheerleading squad, in the schools, where a kid is paid a little bit of money to bring another kid to a party or to sleep over and do some sort of introduction, where perhaps a rape occurs, and then all of a sudden that child or that victim who's been raped has been told that I will tell your parents and I will do the same thing for your younger sister or younger brother or whatever, and then there's that fear element. So it is, you know, not only drug addicts. There is an element of it. Of course, you know, we were talking about this earlier, there is a heroin epidemic in Bucks County, and I think all over Pennsylvania there's been various reports of that. And so, you know, drugs are being used to lure people in, but one of the ADAs in Bucks County was telling me that you have responsible parents that send their kids into rehab, and the traffickers are waiting right outside with the drugs. Wherever the kids are, that's where the traffickers are going to be. If they're online, that's where the traffickers are going to be. If they're shopping, that's where the traffickers are going to be. This is their business, and they're very smart, and they're very calculating, and they will do what it takes to get victims. There's just too much money to be made in this. Another one is that they have to be kidnapped or taken from home. And so, as I'd mentioned to you, coffee shops, they'll meet them in coffee shops, in malls, at parties, on the internet. So, you know, where you've got a daughter, let's just say in particular, who is dating someone and is very secretive about who she's dating, you have to look into that because you don't know if that person has the right intentions. And really, it's not even anymore that this person may only use, let's say, your daughter or your son for their own, you know, for their own pleasure, sick pleasure, so to speak. But now there's so much money to be made, they could end up trafficking them. And then the other thing is, and I've had parents say this to me over and over, but I would know. I would just know, because you'd see like some sort of change in my child. And of course, my child would tell me if they were being trafficked. So the perception is that if my child's being trafficked, then chances are they're missing. They've gone missing, and they are on some posters somewhere, and they've been taken somewhere, and that is not true. You have cases of traffickers who are parked in a car right up the street from where the bus lets off the kid. The parents think the kid is over at so-and-so's house or at a soccer game or whatever the situation is, and that trafficker is taking that kid and trafficking them in a hotel room for a couple hours or down in Kensington and then drives them home. And that trafficker is abusing and manipulating and controlling that particular victim to the extent that that victim knows that when that trafficker says, I will kill your family, I will expose you, and they shame them, those kids are going to keep quiet. And so you've got kids that may start to act out in a way where you think, well, they're just becoming teenagers. Their grades may be dropping or whatever. There's one particular case of a victim survivor who spoke at the cutting of the ribbon at the well, who, you know, was being used in child pornography, and we went to school, went home every single day. Nobody knew. Now, there was some acting out that was occurring. There was something that they noticed was different, so they just started putting her in different types of programs within the school system, thinking that that's what the issue was without really understanding what was happening. So another misconception is, if it was happening to my kid, I would know. Just want you to understand that that is not necessarily the case, and the traffickers know what to say and what to do to keep those kids quiet. So I want to come a little bit closer to how I got involved in this issue. Pastor Chris had mentioned how he got involved, and I want to talk about how I got involved. And like so many people, I was vaguely aware of human trafficking around the world, thought it was happening, well, didn't really think about it, heard things about it in India and other countries. I ended up watching a documentary, Born Into Brothels, because my mom had been a documentary producer, and I thought it was great that there was a documentary that was up for an Academy Award, so I wanted to watch it, and then I watched it, and I was horrified. To learn about what was happening to these kids in India in the red light district, and how they had really no choice in their lives but to end up being trafficked and prostituted. And I wrote a check, I was crying about it, and then I moved on with my lives, because you know the truth of the matter is I was very disconnected from this issue, and I just couldn't relate to it. And then I started praying about it. Every time I'd hear something on the news, I would pray about it. And then eventually I was home one night when the FBI raided my neighbor's house. And it was a rainy night, and you know, they had big picture windows, and a friend and I watched the FBI in the house with all of the SUVs out in front and the jackets and the flashlights and going through the computers. And who lived there was a man and his wife and their son, who was 32 years old, I think, and then his son, who was 8 years old. And we were thinking, well, it has to be drugs. But then it seemed weird because it's the FBI, and they usually don't get involved in, you know, local drug cases. And we thought, well, if it's drugs, it's really a major drug thing. Couldn't find out what was going on until weeks later we all got an envelope with FYI written on our envelopes in all of our mailboxes. And inside was a news story that hit the Courier Times that my neighbor had been
on the radar of the FBI because they had been tracking him accessing, and they believed distributing, child pornography. And they found thousands and thousands and thousands of images on his computer, and many of which were of babies. And all of a sudden, this issue of somebody being enslaved and brutalized in the worst possible means that had been over here for me came full circle and was literally in my backyard, two houses away in a town that isn't even incorporated, in a city where Washington crossed the Delaware and where the war turned around for freedom for America, and this is exactly what was going on. So I just want you to understand that it's a problem in India, it's a problem in Cambodia, it's a problem in other countries, but it is a problem in every single one of your counties, wherever you come from, and potentially in your own neighborhood. And so as I kind of go over these statistics, I know that they're hard, it's overwhelming. The concept of $32 billion, 27 or 30 million people that are enslaved can be very overwhelming. And you can feel like desensitized, that you need more dramatic stories, more dramatic statistics. So if someone was trafficked at the age of 6, you're more horrified than someone who was trafficked at the age of 17, because we can become hardened to this because it's so overwhelming. Or we can maybe feel that if it's happening to our kids, we feel a little bit more fierce about this, the American kids versus the kids overseas, or vice versa. If it's happening overseas, we feel more angry about it, want to do something about it, because the concept of it potentially happening in the United States is a little too overwhelming for us. So in either way, these stories and these statistics can become very overwhelming to us. But the bottom line, and the reason why I share this with you, is that it needs to awaken us to the magnitude of the problem, and that it's shared throughout all humanity in the globe. So whether it's one child, or it's 300,000, or whether the victim's 6 or 22, or whether it's here or there, we need to care about it, and quite frankly, God calls us to. And I want to share with you just a couple of stories. As Pastor Chris had mentioned, I'm a justice advocate, or was a justice advocate, for International Justice Mission. Because when that happened in my neighborhood, it was like God said to me, get off your knees and I want you to start doing something about this. And I got involved with International Justice Mission, started going around talking about this issue, and then ended up on a radio show where I started doing research about what's happening in Pennsylvania and came to find out how epidemic it is. And then God called me to quit my job and to work on this documentary. And I still speak on behalf of IJM, but I just want to tell you a couple stories of someone in India and someone in the United States, because we need to put a face to number. Because a victim anywhere in the world who is being raped or brutalized or in any way oppressed, they don't care about the statistics. They care about what's happening to them, and so should we. As long as there is one person in the world who's being enslaved, God calls us to care about them. So I want to share with you a story about Jyoti, who was from India. And the reason why I want to share this with you is that India is where the largest concentration of enslaved and trafficked people and prostituted children are in the world. It's estimated that over 15 million are enslaved in India, and that over, and by their own government's statistics, that over 2 million children are being prostituted. And so Jyoti is actually very similar, her story is very similar to what happens sometimes in the United States. She was 14 years old. She grew up in an abusive home. She ran away to get safety and to get some help. And she ended up at a bus station and meeting people at a bus station who said that they would help her and that they would get her to safety, and they were women. And they ended up drugging her and selling her to $300 for $300 at a brothel, hundreds of miles of home. They starved her. They beat her and they kept her in a dungeon until she agreed to cooperate. And a lot of times that's referred to kind of breaking the spirit, just sort of whatever they have to do to get you to give in and to cooperate with this. She was sexually assaulted by 20 to 30 men per day in a city with some of the highest HIV/AIDS rates in the world. And months went by with no sign of relief. She said that there was one day where a police officer came in and she thought, oh, thank God, there's going to be a rescue. And of course, the police officer was only there as a John to purchase a child for sex. And so she almost gave up hope. And I want to tell you about a girl named Brianna. Her story really touched me because I think that a lot of parents could relate to this being their child. Brianna's a girl that Shared Hope International tells her story a lot. A beautiful girl, was on the cheerleading squad, was, you know, getting great grades in school, was working, was actually, I think, taking pre-college prep courses or whatever in high school, was working at a waitress in a restaurant in the Washington state. And a customer was coming in all the time and asking her questions about herself, just as, you know, customers will if you're working in that type of environment. And what he was doing was he was taking down information about her. And he was documenting all the answers to the questions because they had targeted her to be trafficked. And she would get a high price. She was a clean girl who was a beautiful young lady. And so she was a very valuable commodity. So this took a long time, and it was a very sophisticated ring that went on. And eventually what happened is that this information was fed to a guy who came into the restaurant one night with his buddies and was kind of flirting with her, and she was amazed at how much they had in common. Because, of course, the guy knew everything about her and was there for a very specific purpose. And over time, they ended up dating and becoming boyfriend and girlfriend, and she was crazy in love with him. And we know that the development of the brain, you know, doesn't fully occur until you're in your 20s, right? So when you're a 17-year-old girl, and I've been there, and, you know, some hot guy is really interested in you, and he seems sophisticated and whatever, it is so hard for you to think and imagine that someone would intentionally do this with the purpose of selling you. I mean, it doesn't even enter your mind. So she has this relationship with him. She wants to move up to Seattle where he is to go to school near him. And she doesn't know how she's going to afford it. And he says, well, why don't you dance? There's a lot of people who dance, of course. In the United States, we think it's not a big deal to dance at a strip club. So eventually he gets her to dance in a strip club. It's a horrifying experience. It often is used as a gateway experience to start to break them down and to start to prostitute them. And so this is what happened to her, where she ended up in this relationship. And all the time when she would go up to this house where he was living, this beautiful home outside of Seattle, there were people there that she thought were his friends, but they were potential buyers that were negotiating to take her and eventually sell her into some ring. And so I just want you to set aside for a moment sort of the statistics that I went over with you, and I want you to think about Jyoti and Brianna and some of the boys. We were talking about boys, and it does happen to boys. These are not abstract stories. These are not just statistics. These are human lives. The pain is real. Their bodies are aching. Their spirits are being destroyed. And they suffer at the hand of a real oppressor. I know, thinking back for years when I used to read Bible stories and used to hear, you know, stories about the oppressor, I didn't really put two and two together of how it's actually operating in this world. And if you think about Ecclesiastes 4:1, I looked and saw all the oppression that was taking place under the sun. I saw the tears of the oppressed, and they have no comforter. Power was on the side of the oppressors. Around the world, this is a reality for people. It's not just a word of something that we hear in the Bible. In many places, there's a broken justice system that helps to perpetuate this. In fact, the UN confirms that 60% of the world's population are totally excluded from protection of the law. So can you imagine where you live in the world and where a large percentage of the population lives in the world where you cannot pick up the phone and call 911? You cannot get help. And so oppression is running rampant. And even though in the United States we have one of the most sophisticated justice systems in the world, the truth of the matter is, because of our ignorance and thinking that this can't happen, it almost is worse in a sense. Because we do hear about it in India, we do hear about it in other countries, and we can almost understand it. But when you, and I've had this happen to me many times, when you sit and you tell people it's happy in the United States, they will tell you it is not. I had that happen at a party the other night. I had two parents stand there and tell me it is not happening in Bucks County. And we're denying what I was telling them. And that is part of what perpetuates that in the United States. So these victims are wondering if God is really good, if God exists, if there was a God, what is he doing about it? And what's his plan to deal with it? And they are waiting for someone to enter into their darkness, to step into this with them, and to be willing to fight on their behalf. They start to believe that God does not see. And by the way, and so do the oppressors. They believe that God doesn't see because of what we are doing in this world about this. Well, we all know that God does see this, and we know that he cares. He describes oppression throughout the entire Bible, and ever since I got involved with this, reading the Bible has really changed for me, because I am seeing God describe situations in Cambodia and other places that I've heard in great detail, and his anger and his fury over this and his heart grieving for these victims. In Psalms 10, he lies in wait near the villages for ambush. He murders the innocent, watching in secret for his victims. He lies in wait like a lion in cover. He lies in wait to catch the helpless. He catches the helpless and drags them off in his net. Isaiah 42, but this is a people robbed and plundered. All of them are snared in holes, and they are, and no one delivers for plunder, and no one says restore. Leviticus, do not degrade your daughter by making her a prostitute, or the land will turn to prostitution and be filled with wickedness. And one of the stark images I saw in a documentary I watched about human trafficking was this one village where all these guys were sitting around, they were gambling and they were drinking, and they don't work, and this is what they do all day long, and there aren't any girls in their village because they've sold them all so that they can just sit around and do this all day long. And what does it say in Joel 3? They cast lots for my people and traded boys for prostitutes. They sold their girls for wine that they may drink. Make no mistake about it. God sees it, and he is angry, and he wants something to be done about this. Psalms 10:17, you hear, O Lord, the desires of the afflicted. You encourage them, listen to their cry, defending the fatherless and the oppressed in order that man who is of the earth may terrify no more. Psalms 35, my whole being will exclaim, who is like you, O Lord? You rescue the poor from those too strong for them, the poor and needy from those who rob them. And he has sent a rescuer. We know this. Jesus has rescued us, and Jesus calls us to it. And one of my favorite verses in Luke, the Spirit of the Lord is on me because he anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim freedom for the prisoners, recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. You know these verses inside and out, but this is why these verses were given to us, is because of this issue in particular and what he wants us to do about this. He hears their cries. He longs to bring rescue. We know that he hates oppression and the abuse of power. And so this sort of overwhelming feeling that you may have in this devastation is actually God's spirit in you. And so I want to say now, looking at all your faces, if you could be up here where I am, this is not a fun thing to go around and talk to people about this issue, because you just watch people in the beginning, you know, like nobody's been eating, just like Pastor Chris said, everybody stopped eating, and you just watch the faces just go down. It is really overwhelming and horrifying. But I want to go back to one of the reasons why you guys are here, and that's because there is hope. There is hope. We have hope because we know the heart of God. We've all been rescued from our sins. The rescue has already come. And so we know that God is a God of hope. And so then you ask the question, then what's his plan to deal with this? If you look around the room at everybody at these tables, this is his plan. You and I are his plan to do this. Just like the Mennonite group and the other people who were together years and years ago in America were put on this earth for that particular time, this is why you are here today and why I am here today, because we are the plan. God has no plan B. There is no escape plan. There is no, well, if the people fail, I'll step in and I'll just bomb them all away. We are his plan of rescue. We are his plan to step into the dark places. We are his hands and feet on this earth. In Matthew 22, 37, 40, love your neighbor as yourself. And the picture we're given of our neighbor is a man who is robbed and beaten in need of help, a man from a different culture, someone who that guy had no reason to care about. And that's what I was talking about earlier with human trafficking. He calls us, his church, his people, to share in his passion to bring rescue and redemption and healing to those who are suffering. In Micah, he has told you, O people, what is good and what does the Lord require of you, but to do justice, to love mercy, and walk humbly with your God. Isaiah 1:17, learn to do right, seek justice, rescue the oppressed. Seek justice, rescue the oppressed. Actively involved in what's happening on this earth. In terms of those who are being oppressed, defend the cause of the fatherless and plead the case of the widow. He calls us to seek justice and show mercy. But here's the amazing thing about it, and at IJM, we see this all the time. Coming out of their yearly global prayer gatherings that they have in Washington, D.C., where people come from all the world, they will come with some of the toughest cases that have been sitting in the court system for years and where nothing's been happening, and people will come together and they will pray, and then we will get reports that amazing things are happening. There's just no way that IJM could do the things that they're doing without God meeting them there, actually being there and them meeting God, and Him multiplying the work of what we're doing. That's exactly what God does for us. And I just want to read you something from the Just Church, and I highly recommend as leaders of your own congregations that you get this book. This is a guy who works at International Justice Mission who was a pastor at a church and wrote this really terrific book called The Just Church. And in essence, what he says about sort of American Christianity in particular is the word translated righteousness in Isaiah 58:2 is interesting. In Hebrew, it is tzedakah. I asked one of my Messianic Jewish friends, and she said that's the way you pronounce it. And its meaning, rather than being simply righteousness, is much closer to the combination of the English words righteousness and justice. This may seem like an unimportant detail, but because these two words in English are often so disconnected, this translation decision can significantly influence church doctrine and practice. Among other things, it makes it possible for us to think of Christianity as a disembodied spirituality that separates rightness with God from our social surrounding in general. It makes it possible to pursue personal holiness, or right relationship with God and the benefits thereof, meaning God's favor or blessing, while at the same time completely disregarding the injustice around us. But the fact that both concepts are included in this single word makes it clear, in God's view, we simply cannot have holiness without justice. So I want to go back and think about slavery in the United States before I bring you to Jyoti and what happened to her situation and Brianna. In 1787, there were 12 guys sitting around a table talking about their desire to put an end to the English slave trade. How many people are in here today? 15, 16 people? Yeah, that's all it took. It only took 20 years for slavery the way that it existed back then to be abolished. And think about how many countries were dependent on that economically, and it was socially acceptable. And it took a room full of people just like this to change the course of the world and history. IJAM has seen several miracles, as I had mentioned to you. In Cebu in the Philippines, there was a great availability of minors for sex. And so IJAM went in. They believe in changing the infrastructure through training and helping to change laws and work from within for sustainable change. And so they went into the Philippines, and in a broken justice system, and oftentimes there's corruption, and there's really very little reason why people would even want to change it. And so this is an example of where they went into. And the Bill Gates Foundation gave them a grant to study what's a sustainable, and they were hoping that they would reduce the availability of minors for sale by about 20%. And they found after 4 years that the availability had been reduced by nearly 80%. If it can happen in the Philippines, explain to me why it cannot happen in the United States, where we have the justice system that we do, the technology that we do, the training that we do, and in the country where we have the freedom and the rights that we do. Tell me that this can't happen in the United States. Let's go back to Jyoti. Months went by with no sign of relief, and one day in the brothel, there was someone who had been victimized like she was, who said that she'd heard about this God named Jesus. It was the first time that Jyoti ever heard of Jesus. And so without having, going to church or having internet to listen to sermons or having someone to really witness to her, all that she did was just start saying, Jesus, 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 Jesus. Do you think he cared? Of course he cared. Do you think he wanted somebody to go in and rescue her? Of course he did. Do you think he wanted for her to know that there was a God that cared about her, that in the millions of people that were being brutalized every single day, that she mattered? Absolutely. So within a couple of weeks, 2 weeks after she started praying, IJAM went in and they were able to rescue her. And she has since gone in and helped to rescue other people. She was so emboldened by her rescue and really came to know Jesus as her Savior that she stepped out on behalf of others. Brianna, her situation, she ended up wanting to go move in with her boyfriend. She contacted an old boyfriend to try to help her get situated, and her old boyfriend started hearing how the story was going and what was happening in her life, and it sounded like a trafficking situation. So he had her over at his house, and in a back room he had her parents and a woman who's involved in human trafficking and his parents, and they did an intervention, and Brianna was saved, and now she goes around and she teaches people about this. So there are people who are coming out of this when people step in and are willing to help, and even if they know a little bit. Brianna's a great example of that, where her life was saved. People have showed up for Jyoti. Jyoti showed up for Kalindi, who was another person who'd been rescued. Kalindi's shown up for other people. This is how it happens and how God spreads it. And it's happening in the United States. And I want to say it's possible to change the course of history just by offering the skills, the position that you're in, especially as leaders of your churches, the willingness and the heart. It's possible for that to become safe and healing place for all those in pain, but it's going to take all of us. It will take us all relentlessly pursuing the passionate call from God. It will take courage and faith and prayer. And I'm really glad that you guys are going to be planning on praying, because that's so desperately needed, that we take back the land through prayer, and that we take back those that are being victimized through prayer. And quite frankly, that repentance would sweep across the state, because God cares not just about the victims, but he cares about the perpetrators as well. And there is hope for them as well. But it will not be easy. And as Pastor Chris can tell you, since I started working on this film, my dog almost died. All kinds of things have happened that have been brutally difficult to overcome. It has been a journey that is unbelievable. My friends have cried with me and for me, watching me go through this, because we have a real enemy that does not want this to change, does not want you to care, does not want you to get involved, does not want you to pray. Because he knows what can happen if you do. And so he will do everything he can to stop you from taking this beyond hearing this today, from praying, from bringing it before your churches, because he wants this to continue to perpetuate and for that number to go from 30 million beyond. But you have the power with Christ to do some damage, as you did as a body of believers 150 years ago or more. So I encourage you to step forward with courage and to not let this die today, and to work with your churches to figure out what you can do, and as a group of leaders together and in your own communities, in your own families, certainly if you have children. And so I just want to encourage you to step forward, to carry on the Mennonite legacy, and I thank you for taking this time this morning for listening. I'll be praying for you, and I can't wait to hear what's going to come out of it. Thank you.
We are living into our legacy. Debbie is our current day abolitionist speaker, coming up to the Mennonite folks who live in the hinterlands, out of a passionate engagement, inviting you to be part of today's abolitionist movement. Folks who lived in Philadelphia, who were much more active in the abolition movement, knew that the Mennonite folks up here were critical. And we are living a little bit of that again today, hearing some language that's familiar to us, some that isn't, some passion that goes in directions that sometimes where we are more reserved. Debbie, just thanks for your invitation, for your passion, for your willingness to take risk, for your ability to keep telling hard stories, and for just being with us here today. We don't have time for questions for Debbie, but I think Debbie probably can linger around if you want to talk with her a bit. Couple things that we want to invite you to consider, couple things I want to celebrate. This may well be the first equipping resourcing breakfast that we've had that has drawn people from outside Franconian Eastern District Conference. So I want to say welcome to our folks who are here from the Hopewell Network of Churches. Thanks for being here with us. That's something to pay attention to. The other thing is that as I look at the room, you represent the diversity of congregations that is our conference within Bucks and Montgomery County. Samantha and I get to represent the churches that are in the cities. Samantha and I are staff people for the anti-trafficking movement. Thing to say, within Franconia Conference. We've been meeting with a number of people, Josh and Chris, as well as Adrian Suryajaya from Philly Praise Center. I feel like I'm missing somebody else, but we've had another committee person who's not there, so who hasn't been there yet. But we want to invite you to think about ways to take action this morning. And one of the things that came out of our work was this idea of doing public prayer witness. As we were meeting together, I've never read that document, and I've talked about that document a lot, and I live up Germantown Avenue. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting to hear someone else reiterate our story and to bring it back to us. Was we were sitting around in the task force, we said, what if today's Mennonite community is known for bringing an end to modern day slavery? What if that's our call and invitation? What if that is our space to work in? One of the things I want to, we wanted to invite you to think about doing public action, and that's a little bit more risky. We have a number of places that are considered hotspots within our geographic conference boundaries that are proximate to Philly. And Chris and Debbie have been talking about that. What would it be like for us to do public prayer witness at the places that are considered hotspots? And so we want to make sure to get your emails today to invite you to consider being a part of that. Chris, we don't have a date or anything set for that, right?
No, I'm going to look at some Mondays for myself and figure out a location that makes sense.
Yeah.
Do it on a Monday and see what kind of things God's going to do when we show up in prayer. That's what I'm planning on doing.
So we know that some of those are 309 corridor, the 78 corridor, and the airport corridor. If we think of our three primary areas of being Bucksmont, Philadelphia, and Allentown. So looking in those spots, finding ways to be at full presence. We'll continue to work at that and continue to invite you to be part of that. We also know that Reading is part of that hotspot realities. I'm not sure if those of you who are closer that direction might want to consider that direction as well. We'll gladly share information. But one of the things I want to invite you to do in a good community organizing fashion is if you are a leader here within your congregation to think about how to carry this information back, to think about who is it that you should talk to, who is it that needs to be part of the conversation, who do you wish was here. What platforms do you have to share this information? The Mennonite Church USA has a statement that came from Mennonite women from 2009. Because we've been so involved with so many other controversial things, we've actually ignored this statement altogether. And it's around human trafficking, both sex trafficking and labor trafficking. I will tell you as a conference minister, I deal with labor trafficking issues all the time. And it is not bounded to Lehigh and Philadelphia County. There is a congregation in this room who I represent in the room where I have had discussions about labor trafficking issues. So it is not limited to urban contexts. It is not limited to India. It is very realistic. Possibility and reaching our neighbors, that's one of the things that comes up. One of the things I can tell you is we have a little bit of expertise at the conference level on dealing with the immigration issues around that. So if you encounter that, talk to me at any time. I will tell you that I regret that I didn't know more than what I know now when I first dealt with it, because we could have helped someone escape if I would have known what I know now. So I always carry that person's image in my mind. His name is Andre, and it's probably why I'm here today. For being here. The next piece in the trafficking awareness journey will happen at Conference Assembly. Miguel Lau, who actually has worked briefly for Franconia Conference in our collaboration with Biblical Seminary, and is now on staff at International Justice Mission as a global church mobilization staff person. He'll be actually doing a seminar at Franconia Conference Assembly, which is November 15th, Saturday. So pay attention in the afternoon. We'll try to get more information out to you about that. That is our sort of next installment along with the prayer action. Many of you are working closely with Worthwhile Wear and The Well. There are also networks both based in Philadelphia and in Lehigh Valley that work actively on these issues. We encourage all of you to find spaces where we can work, One of our good stories, Debbie, is that the building where Worthwhile Wear is opening its thrift shop, even though it's going to compete against our Mennonite-owned thrift shops, the building is actually owned by someone from Doylestown Mennonite. So it's a good part of our story. We know that there are lots of spaces to be involved, lots of practical realities to be involved with, but I wonder what it might be like and what kind of invitations we can continue to work at to being a part of today's abolition movement, and to think about that it just happens over breakfast at Henning's. So I'm grateful for that. Thanks again for everyone for taking your time. I'm going to invite Samantha to Debbie as a sort of sending and blessing prayer for us, and we will consider you a collaborator in helping to tell our story and inviting us to live even more faithfully into the call of the gospel, as well as into our own legacy as being radical followers of Jesus who happen to land in this part of Penn's Woods, claimed from the Lenape. The other thing I do want to say that I forgot, Just Church, author is actually Mennonite. Jim Martin, as part of Washington Community Fellowship, a Virginia Conference congregation. I've actually just realized that. He is, International Justice Mission has not had much Mennonite influence, but he is the Mennonite presence in the organization. So he's an elder at Washington Community Fellowship in D.C. So thanks, Debbie.
Thank you.
Samantha, pray us out as well as praying alongside for Debbie.
Contact information, and I can help you think about ways that your church or you can even get involved a little bit more. It's actually what I've been doing this last year too with the film. A lot of people contact me through the film to figure out how they can get involved, and that's really the goal of the film. So I just want to put that up there. Thanks. So thank you for your prayer.
Yeah, thank you so much for being. Can I hand on you? All right, let's pray together. Our Creator and Creator of all people, all things. And we praise you for the chance to be aware, and we thank you for our sister Debbie. And we thank you for your heart of compassion, and we thank you for your holy anger that burns against oppression. Fill us now with your spirit of wisdom. Fill us with courage and discernment to know how it is that you are calling us. And what is the next step, the one step that we can take? By your grace, let everything fall away that is not what is ours to do, and let the feeling of overwhelming sorrow not paralyze us. So show us, God, what it is that is ours to take up, and let us not be distracted by what seems too big or what seems too hard, but let us take that step, that next step. I do pray your blessing on our sister Debbie. Pray that you would continue to encourage her spirit. Thank you for her boldness, and continue to embolden her and embolden all of us in the places where we are timid. Thank you for her passion that is your passion alive within her, and give her strength and let her feel very clearly your accompaniment as she continues in this way. And let us each know that you have gone before us, that you are in the midst of this, that Jesus, you are already in the places where this abuse and these horrors are happening, so that when we arrive, we know that we are simply joining you. Holy Spirit, continue to refresh and sustain and empower us in the work that you are doing for the sake of your kingdom coming here on earth. We pray in the name of Jesus. Amen.